On the Empire Podcast this week, we swing into action with the Amazing Spider-Man director and producers Mark Webb, Avi Arad and Matt Tomac. We get in the mood for Lukas Moodysson as the Swedish director drops by to talk his new movie, We Are the Best. And there's usual movie news, reviews and nonsense on the movie podcast, The Starting to Believe. Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast, the last before Easter, yes. It's a time of year when we all come together and take a moment to think about the selfless sacrifice of a truly great man who died so we all could live. I'm talking, of course, about Harry Stamper from Armageddon. Also with me today, requesting permission to shake the hand of the daughter of the bravest man they've ever met, are three of my glorious and esteemed colleagues, close personal friends, cousins, doctors, gardeners. First up is our reunion's master, the man who brought the Goonies back together. He was the Three Amigos' brand new El Guapo, and he proved that Mel Gibson and Danny Glover weren't too old for this shit. He's just about to head off to LA for his next reunion. It's a Magnificent Seven reunion, or as I like to call it, Robert Vaughn alone in the hotel room staring at the clock with mounting horror. It's Nick Desemlian. Hello, sir.
Sorry, Chris. It's actually Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed. It's been 10 years. Can you believe it?
Really?
Yeah.
No, it hasn't.
Mm-hmm. It's also been 10 years since Mean Girls. It's also been 10 years since Napoleon Dynamite.
Hang on a second. It has been 10 years since Scooby-Doo 2.
I reviewed Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed.
No!
I remember distinctly, because I'd been up very late the night before. And I sort of zoned out and...
Which is pretty much how they made the film.
I think they were up late the night before
they had to finish the film, and they were like, oh God, we better do something quick. Oh yeah, that'll do.
James Gunn wrote that.
Yes, he did. I take it all back. Next up is our podcast editor, a man who loves comedy so much so he's currently trying to reunite the Pythons. Wonder how that's going to work out. It's Ali Plum.
Fingers crossed, guys.
I don't know.
I've got one big holdout.
And last but not least is our geek queen, who's currently in talks to reunite her mind with her body after the former was blown by this week's episodes of Game of Thrones. How's it working out for you, Helen O'Hara?
It's working out well. Can you believe spoiler? I mean, spoiler, right?
That bit with Stannis. OMG.
Did anyone see last night's MasterChef? Greg Wallace died in last night's MasterChef.
He was beheaded by a carelessly used julienne.
As John Troda leaned in and whispered Hell Hydra and then decapitated Greg Wallace with one mighty swipe of his paw. Welcome all to the pod booth. First order of business, as it invariably is, oh God, I'm going to be all over the place in this one, is to tackle your questions and comments you've sent in this week via Facebook. We have a Facebook question, email and Twitter. First one is from Twitter at Mark Burridge, who asks, is VOD affecting your purchases of DVD/Blu-rays?
VOD still sounds like some kind of venereal disease,
I'm sorry.
I guess it has, hasn't it?
100%, yeah, it really definitely has. I'm not buying as many DVDs and Blu-ray.
It's horrible because I lament the passing of HMV, and I still love it when I go to a Westfield and I see an HMV clinging desperately onto life. And yeah, I'm part of the problem now.
I guess.
I haven't bought a Blu-ray for a long time.
I buy Blu-rays, but they've got to be really fancy. I like the cardboard boxes. I like the additional stuff. Like, as an example of something which I view as just what the basic should be, you can buy certain series of Futurama on Blu-ray which have a copy of the script that won an Emmy in a small booklet. It has a t-shirt that comes with it. Maybe not every Blu-ray should have that, but it just really makes a difference.
There's just so much available for free. Well, not for free, but you know, for you to binge on something. Like you mentioned Futurama, which I'm watching on Sky Go at the moment, and it's like, am I going to spend lots and lots of money? It would be nice to have all the extra stuff, but I can watch every episode as part of my Sky package. So,
but I'm the kind of guy that listens, at least when it comes to Futurama and The Simpsons, to commentaries and the deleted scenes and the animatics and all that stuff. I wonder when I'll ever have the time to do it twice. I mean, isn't that why you buy a Blu-ray? But, you know, I've got it. Mm. It looks good on my shelf.
I think I buy my favourite shows. So sometimes the VOD can be a kind of a tester. And then if I really love it, I will sort of buy it as a tribute to its awesomeness.
I will say as well, I'm very, very much about the physical copy. I love having a shelf of, or several shelves of Blu-rays and DVDs. I still love that. A little bit stony broke at the moment, so I haven't bought anything for a while. But there is something, you know, VOD is getting better. Whenever Love Film became Amazon Prime Instant Video about a month ago, I wasn't very happy with the choice. I thought the choice was pretty ropey. And then I actually took like a morning to go through it. And there's some real gems in there, some stuff that, you know, you would struggle to find on Blu-ray. For example, on Saturday, I just sat and watched a great Hammer movie, one of the great sort of unsung Hammer movies, Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter, because it was on Amazon Prime Instant Video. And it's great. And Netflix are getting better in that sort of way. And Sky as well. You know, it's great being a Sky subscriber because As you guys know, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, I still haven't seen a single episode of Game of Thrones. I've had the first season box set for a year and a half, and I still haven't opened it. I'm planning to. I'm going to get around to it. I've just started the Hannibal. I'm about to, once that's done, I'm going to get into Game of Thrones. But I've got the first season Blu-ray. But right now, you can download every single episode in HD on Sky. So I've got I've got seasons 2 and 3 and every episode of season 4 as it comes, primed and ready to go.
Netflix is still much better for TV than for film, I think. There isn't much in the way of new films. And actually, on Netflix, if you type in a director's name, you kind of realise the shortcomings. They've got like one Spielberg film, one Peter Jackson film.
Yeah.
There isn't a huge library of stuff there yet.
I think that'll change, though. And I think what will happen is, I don't think any one provider will be able to give you all the answers. I think you'll be able to just switch around, whether it's Xbox Video, whether it's pay-per-view on Sky, which does some stuff. Xbox Video does. iTunes are great as well. They've got a wonderful library. Then there's Amazon Prime Instant Video, for which you pay, like, I think it's something like £80 a year for Amazon Prime, and then you get that as a part of your subscription. And then there's obviously Netflix, which is £6 a month. I mean, so, I don't know, does that add up ultimately to more than I would spend on Blu-rays every month? But do I get more for more bang for my buck, I guess? I guess I do. I do feel bad. I do feel bad sometimes about watching something when I know I could go out and support a physical industry, when I could go out and support a Blu-ray industry and a shop as well in HFV, a great institution that's dying. And it's dying because of people like us.
Damn you.
Damn us. Damn us all to hell. So yes, Mark Burridge, I think the answer is yes. Next question is from email. It's via email. Only from someone who refers to himself only as Mysterious Marty.
Oh, an Oscar winner.
Hi, guys. Love the podcast. Been listening since the very start, back in those ropey days. Lol, only joking.
Outrageous.
Definitely still salty.
Genuine email, and you're absolutely on the money. Has there ever been a film or scene that was so intense, disturbing, or gory that you've walked out or felt that you might have to walk out? For my money, Death by Fire Extinguisher or and Unfortunate Incident in an Underpass in Irreversible came close. Now, given that it's quite early in Irreversible, that's quite interesting. Keep the good work up.
The Ghost of Christmas Past from The Muppets Christmas Carol. Definitely there.
That's chilling. What worried you most?
I have a serious answer. I'll probably have my film critic card cut up for this, but I have never made it through Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, and watched about 10 minutes and it really freaked me out, so I turned it off and I just have never faced it.
Well, what is it about it that makes you a bit squeamish? Is it the dinner table scene? Do you get that far?
Nope.
So you don't know when
I don't think they even made it to the house.
Were there any chainsaws involved by the time you were there?
No, honestly, nothing had happened. It was the atmosphere of it and I was just like,
You watching it by yourself?
No, I was watching it with a friend.
Oh, wow.
And we put something else on. I should probably watch it. It's probably not anywhere near as bad as I'm imagining it is. It's just I always get scared in horror movies before anything bad happens. As soon as the killings start, I'm fine. But it's like I remember seeing The Descent and just being absolutely terrified, the preamble to all the horribleness. Actually, when all the blood and mayhem starts, it's not as bad. In your mind, it's always kind of worse.
Yeah, The Descent was really, really scary. I would say, I mean, something like the Curb incident in American History X made me, you know, scream quite a lot and want to be elsewhere. But I didn't leave the film, thank goodness. I generally haven't left when any of these things have happened because I have found, I think like you, it's better to push through. If you can push through to the end, generally speaking, you know, you end up less traumatised than I think you might if you... Like, I'm probably more traumatised by The Human Centipede because I have not seen it than I might be if I saw it and decided it was a bit rubbish.
Yeah, my friend who I was living with for a few months was watching The Human Centipede just because, I want to watch it. Do you want to watch it with me? No, I'll be all right. So I went to my room, was reading a book or whatever, and I could just hear the noise of The Human Centipede. The movie, if you just hear the audio, is the scariest radio show you will ever hear. It is so odd. The Foley artistry on that film, say what you like about it, but the Foley work is excellent.
there are films that I'm too scared to tackle. I was just talking to our freelancer Simon Crook yesterday about Martyrs, and just from what I've heard about that, I don't want to go near it.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's, you know, I don't think it's your bag.
Probably not.
So I don't
parts of Ghostbusters 2.
Pretty much the entirety of Ghostbusters 2 is just
okay,
awful. I'm just Nick Beatty. I like Ghostbusters 2. I like it.
Come on, guys.
You're never here whenever people defend Ghostbusters 2. You're never on.
There are people defending Ghostbusters 2 when I'm not here?
Nah. Although someone did tweet in and say they preferred it to Ghostbusters.
Last time I was on the podcast, we were talking about final shots of movies, and Phil asked me about the final shot of Ghostbusters 2. I couldn't think of it until just after the podcast. It's amazing.
What is it?
It's the painting of the guys. Do you remember the painting and magically appears?
Yes.
And it's Bill Murray holding a baby?
It was amazing.
It is moving.
It's moving?
Is it just a random baby?
Only emotionally, huh?
Oh, okay.
No, it's it's the Danny
Barrett's
baby. It's the baby from the film.
It's the baby from the film.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Let's move on then to a question from NC Lowe, at NC Lowe, a regular question contributor. If you could do a podcast on any non-Empire related subject, what would you choose and who would co-host?
I would go for Discworld and with Helen.
Then
get a disc room.
I better say the same.
Oh my God.
I would do a podcast about Ali. But with Chris,
you wouldn't want to get too close to the source material.
Absolutely not.
We should all do a podcast about each other and call it the Human Centipod.
No.
You know
Either
what?
That. No.
That's good.
Yeah. Do you like that?
I'm not laughing.
Keep it in.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Okay. So you would do that Discworld. That's a real
yeah,
answer.
Yeah. Like that has enough depth to justify. That's not to do with films.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've got to exclude TV here as well because we talk enough about TV. But yeah. I just feel like there's enough of a world there and enough auxiliary stuff. God bless them. They've pumped out some amazing... Helen and I both got the Discworld board game, but they do maps, they do diaries, they do... I recommend the diaries. Obviously, posters and the artwork and everything. So, yeah, that's something I really want to dig deep on.
Would you like to hear that, listeners? If you would like to hear Helen and Ali, you know...
Well, join our Kickstarter fund.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
We'll need 50p and a packet of crisps.
Well, Helen, you'll be too busy presenting your own podcast about...
I was thinking it'd probably be, again, either some kind of book-related podcast. That would be fun. Uh-huh. And it would be an excuse for people to send me free books, which would be much to be wished. Or maybe like something, you know, historical or something. Just give me an excuse.
So you've given us a lot of thought.
Something historical in the sense of I would like to talk about, for example... my favourite, you know, kings and queens and the most interesting historical periods, maybe with somebody who actually knows more about it than I do, so I could bend their ear. So like, you know, Henry IV of France or Henry II of England or Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is fascinating.
Who's your favourite king or queen? Pick it quickly.
Eleanor of Aquitaine.
That is a good answer.
She was married to Henry II, right? She divorced the King of France despite having had two kids by him on the grounds of herself being barren, which is clearly nonsense. Then she had like six kids with the King of England. And she was the most powerful landowner in Europe at the time. She was pretty kick-ass.
Well, that is a hot preview of this,
right?
Of Helen's new podcast.
See, that could be awesome, right?
Wow.
I'm in.
Mine's King Ralph.
Unsubscribe.
Mine would clearly be about football.
Obviously.
Big fan of the football.
Obviously.
No, it wouldn't be football. It would probably be... I'd do something on board games. I bet there are lots of podcasts already
board
about
board games.
Games.
There are several.
I like board games.
I love a board game.
I've discovered...
What's your best board game?
Very good. Well... That's a big question.
Settlers of Catan, right?
Escape from Colditz is amazing. You could play as a Nazi. I don't approve of that. It's not good. My favourite game of recent times is got to be Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, which is quite an old game, but it's bloody good.
Have you ever played Pandemic?
No.
That's an excellent game.
Okay, let's do this podcast.
I highly recommend it. I would also recommend a board game called Ticket to Ride.
Ooh,
which is very good, yeah.
You can play as Ringo, Paul.
Yeah, all the big names. There's four. No, it's about making a train line, and this is when it gets exciting. Across America!
Choo-choo!
Oh my God.
I know, right?
I'm totally down for
it. I love board games. Great. Let's do it. Who would you get to co-host? Not us, Twan, because you'd get someone famous, wouldn't you?
It would either be the boot or the hat.
I would get Brian Cox involved. I bet he's a board gamer.
Which one? The actor?
Both, that's it. We get both. You host, and then they... play a board game with each other.
Amazing.
All right, well,
that's amazing.
This is fun.
That's amazing. Discworld, something about something.
Shut up.
And board games. Awesome. I'm going to be really boring, and I would do a podcast about Liverpool Football Club.
No.
It is my obsession. There we go. All right, so Chris Lawrenson via Facebook, and I apologize for this one, Chris Lawrenson, because you sent this question in 6 months ago. I've only just seen it. Very simple. I can't believe we've never been asked this before. What's your zombie attack plan?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Zombie defense plan, right?
Well,
yeah.
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 Defense, but
like,
also...
as in, when zombies attack, what's your plan? Slow zombies, right?
Slow zombies or fast zombies? Fast zombies, frankly, we're all fucked.
Yeah.
It has to be slow zombies.
Yeah.
Okay, so slow zombies. How much warning do we get? Can we stockpile food? Or is it very much like overnight, our neighbour's got a bit bite.
Well, I think even if you stockpile food, like, you're going to run out and you're going to have to venture out at some point. So even if you've stockpiled like a week, you're probably still going to have to get out there.
Yeah.
I think we're, you know, we're in the scenario where stuff is going seriously
Are we
wrong.
Fighting off people in the local Sainsbury's? Is it martial law?
Other supermarkets are available.
I'm just thinking about my nearest. Yeah. Tesco's just down the road as well. Lidl, always a good choice.
if you go to Waitrose, you get a better class of zombie.
You do get a bit artisan bread.
I think about this all the time, and my plan involves taking the walkie-talkies I have, the Nerf guns I have. My girlfriend's obsessed. When we last talked about a zombie attack, she went, "I need a pannier rack. My bike needs a pannier rack. I cannot survive."
What the hell's that?
The zombie apocalypse with a pannier rack. It's the small bag holder that you can put on the side of your back wheel.
Ooh, that's good.
For a bike. And our plan is to cycle back to where I grew up, which is in a village just north of Reading, because my mum is an incredible hoarder of ceramics, newspapers, and canned goods.
And board games.
And board games, yeah. And Discworld books. And we'll just cycle all the way back there as fast as we can. Also, we also talk about what projectiles would be good, like kind of homemade projectiles to throw at zombies' heads. And recently I've decided it's got to be a small, full jam jar. It's got the heft, it's got the weight.
Yeah.
If it hits the forehead, it'll break and the glass will go into the brain.
Mm. That does work.
Yep. I just want to slow them down a bit. Like, I'm not saying it's going to kill them.
That's too close quarters. I would get a sword or a large pointy stick and just spin around constantly.
Yeah, but
that's
I don't
still
have any
close
swords.
Quarters.
No, not jam jar is too...
The answer, I think...
Could bite your hand.
The answer, I think, for all of us is that we need to get to wherever James Dyer is. Because you know that our James has hordes of supplies. He has several swords, so we could get one each.
He'll kill us as soon as we get into his garden.
He might kill us
if
when we get
brush
in the garden.
Past his lavender bush, we'll be all dead. Because he'll just have wire traps and, you know, swinging blades coming out of trees. I mean,
to be fair, this is James's plan if a postman appears. Never mind zombies. So, I don't know. Will we not try and get here for one last pause? You know, just for old time's sake. I don't know. I think my flat's pretty good at the moment because it's quite difficult to access.
Mm-hmm.
And you could block off the front door fairly easily. And then all you would do is just climb in and out the window with a ladder to run across the road to get some supplies.
I might go to the Tower of London.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that worked out quite well in World War Z. They used the fortresses of Europe as bases for, during the zombie attack there. I mean, the book, obviously, not the film. And, you know, you could reflood the moat of the Tower of London fairly easily, one would imagine. And then that would be pretty tough to take. The only problem, of course, would be clean drinking water and food.
Quick question for Ali. Is there a zombie board game?
Yes, there is. Well, actually, Pandemic is... It's not about zombies, but it's a similar kind of infection thing.
Okay.
But yes, there are many. I don't know any well enough to tell you one to recommend, but there are many, many, many.
Well, there's Monopoly. Anyone? No? Okay. Bueller? Anyone? Basically, we're all dead.
Yeah, pretty
okay.
much.
Okay. Thanks for your questions. If you want to get in touch, we're on Facebook as Empire Magazine. And look, we do read your Facebook questions eventually. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine, and we're use the hashtag, please, Empire Podcast. Otherwise, we won't see it. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Time now for our first interview. Lucas Moodysson is a brilliant director of such eye-catching, occasionally sunny, occasionally experimental, always thought-provoking indie fare as Together and Lelia Forever. His new movie, We Are the Best, is out on Friday and is about a three-piece punk girl band. He popped into the pod booth recently to talk to, well, who else? Our art house guru, Phil Dissemblian, and Ali Plum.
Our outhouse guru.
Our outhouse guru. Enjoy.
Really, really love this movie.
It's
got great you've got great feedback, great it's reactions.
It's quite extroverted. Yeah.
Do you reject the sort of labels of extrovert and introvert?
No, but we're all a combination, so
we're all divergent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wondered if the two characters, Bobo and Clara, have very dramatic haircuts. And I wondered if when you were sort of 13, 14 years old, you had a similarly punkish do.
I think there are so many portrayals of punk today where people look enormously really perfect, like I really wanted them to have sort of half failed kind of so yeah, I also had those kind of failed haircuts a lot that didn't really look the way I had expected them to look. And so, like, you know, you look at some pictures and then you want and you see yourself in the mirror, it's not the same.
You didn't take pictures of like Malcolm McLaren into the hairdressers and say, can you do that for me? And then
no, it was more like I didn't go to a hairdresser, it was you do it yourself and your friends or something. So
the two main characters in We're the Best, Bobo and Clara, they kind of reject a lot of the conformity of the high school stuff in the way that you've seen a lot of American movies, but in a slightly sort of different way, I guess. Mm-hmm. Musically, neither of them are sort of amazing musicians when they start out, should we say?
No.
But they write some great material, one of which is a kind of rejection of school sport, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah,
sport in general.
Yeah, I think that was actually a difficult song for Mira Grusin to sing because she really loves sports.
Really?
She's a football player, and so that was when I asked what was the most difficult thing about making the film, it felt quite difficult to suddenly hate sports.
She felt like she was betraying her teammates and stuff.
Yeah.
So you had to coax her through that.
Yeah.
Was it easy to find those two actors? Because they put in beautiful sort of naturalistic performances, very unselfconscious.
Well, both yes and no. I think the unselfconsciousness that you mentioned is really important, and I think that's sort of the kind of sickness or talent of being an actor, that you have that ability to forget that the camera is there and to be, well, relaxed maybe is the wrong word, but because that sounds like you're sort of leaning backwards, but sort of like being able to be very present in the moment and not and forgetting about everyone else in the room. And I think that's something you're more or less born with. And I could of course see that we auditioned maybe 1,000 children, kids, and so I saw immediately that they had these two had that kind of talent. But at the same time, you have to make sure that they fit together. So it took a very long time to sort of trying to figure out who and how. Actually, I once decided I will never make a movie again with children, because it just feels so terrible to reject people, to build up people's dreams, young people's dreams, and say that you're great and this is fantastic and everything, and please come back to do another audition, and then just say no, you didn't get the part. And that's just, I hate that.
That's very hard.
But I never, never, never say anything negative.
No.
I'm extremely positive, and I try to encourage people a lot and say that, and also to tell the truth, that sort of you're extremely talented, but for exactly this part in this film,
yes,
it didn't really match. But sort of, so I try really to be very, very super positive the whole time.
Can you do that with this podcast as well at the end?
Just say encouraging things.
We need building up. We always need building up. You have, I think, quite unusually amongst filmmakers, a Tumblr page, mm-hmm. which you lovingly update regularly, and it's full of really fascinating things that mm-hmm. give an insight into stuff that moves you and, mm-hmm. and inspires you creatively. One of those things, surprisingly perhaps, is Rihanna.
Mm-hmm. It's The Cure and Rihanna. Those are my main.
There's some Miley Cyrus up there as well, and lots of.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily. Yeah, but because that's mostly because I want to be on the side of people who are bullied, and I think that she's crazy and being bullied the whole time. So that's why I'm on her side, not necessarily because I love all her music, really.
Okay.
But with Rihanna and The Cure, it's because I like what they do, 100%.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Do you like her in front of the camera as well? Have you seen, for instance, Battleship?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
We Are the Best is adapted from a graphic novel
mm-hmm.
by your wife.
Mm-hmm.
And how is the process of making that happen? Did you work quite closely on adapting it, or was it something where you just took it away?
No, we work in two rooms. We have a small office we call it an office, where I sit in one room and she sits in the next room. So we're always close together. We're like together 24 hours a day. So physically close, yeah. But at the same time, both of us felt that she had made a really nice graphic novel, and I was going to do a film of it. And they were like two separate things. So it's not like the film is the perfection or the sort of the final version. It's like two different things. So she wasn't involved at all, actually, except for when I always ask her for advice when it comes to things like what should they wear and things like that, or what kind of music should they listen to in that scene, or that kind of specific details. But the script, no. She was just really happy that I wanted to do something funny and something with energy, because she felt that I had spent too much time writing really depressing things.
Did you think so?
Yeah, she was right. Yeah, I'd written two novels that I'm really proud of, but they're really slow, and not slow, but really sad and meditative or something like that, and not a lot of energy in them.
Yeah.
So it felt like very nice to sort of do something else, and also, as we talked about before regarding introvert and extrovert, there is something interesting in being a writer and then, which is very introvert, and then going out to make a film which is very extrovert, because you have to work with a group of people. So I think that was also good for me to sort of suddenly be in a social context again.
I heard an interesting sort of definition, which I hadn't heard before, about extroverts and introverts, that an extrovert is someone that derives energy from other people.
And extrovert.
An extrovert does, okay. Yes. And I suppose you couldn't help but be energized by this cast. They seem to have, you know, it reminded me of watching Together, where mm-hmm. it feels like they've got so much energy in front of the camera.
Yeah, but it was really a fun film to make. More fun than Together, actually. I think Together was actually... I don't know. I remember wrong, but it felt like that was more difficult film to make. But this one was really easy, and it was really nice to make it the whole time.
So. Was it difficult because of practical considerations, or was it difficult because it obviously has some difficult subjects? You know, it's, I guess, in some ways a more serious film, you could argue.
The connection between how it feels to make a film and what the film turns out to be is sort of very, very complicated.
Yes.
And I think some of the most sort of sad and dark things I've made, I felt really great when I made them. Yeah. So it doesn't really match. This is a film that actually matches, because I felt quite nice when we were making the film, and I hope that some of that energy is in the film. Yeah,
100%. Together is a film that people have incredible fondness for. Are you sort of, do you get a lot of people wanting to come up and chat to you about that film?
It's interesting with different countries. I think that it actually worked better in the UK than in some other places. So in Sweden, the film that everybody remembers me for in Sweden, or that I'm mostly associated, is my first film, Fucking Normal,
yes,
Love,
which is not called that anywhere else.
In some places, yes, in Scandinavia, in Norway, Denmark, yes.
But we got a bit coy and we called it Show Me Love.
Yeah.
Which is maybe not quite as punchy a title.
No. I know that it's actually called Raus aus Omol in Germany.
What does that mean translated?
It means get out of house, you know.
Like. Get out the fucking house.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's Show Me Love in English and America, and it's get out of the fucking house in Germany.
Yep.
Amazing. I know that you're a fan of lists. And I don't know if you're mm-hmm. a fan of lists of films, but Together, mate, we had a few years back, we had an Empire Top 500 movies, mm-hmm. and Together was there between Woody Allen's Radio Days and William Wyler's The Best Years of Our Lives. Have you seen those two films?
Woody Allen, yes.
Are you a Woody Allen aficionado?
No, because I'm not really a film aficionado in general.
Ah.
No, really?
All other directors are enemies, so I don't like films.
They're your enemies.
Yeah, I think that's true for all directors, actually. We just sometimes pretend that we like each other's work. That's why it's much easier for me to like Rihanna or something, because she's not an enemy of me.
He's not competing with you.
No, we're not competing.
What happens if Rihanna starts directing movies? She comes right off your Tumblr.
No, but it has to. It depends on if they're good enough. If they're really bad, then it's okay, because it's much easier for me to like something. I mean, and especially when I'm at home and I want to see something on I have sort of very simple taste sometimes in film. Mm. I have simpler taste in film than in literature, for example. When it comes to literature, I have really sort of strange taste, but when I'm in film, I just want to see something stupid and funny.
Who do you feel the competition most from? If you say that all directors are competitors, who do you feel is the person snapping at your heels?
Ingmar Bergman.
Michael Bay,
yeah, I'm sure Michael Bay, yeah.
Ingmar Bergman, though, I mean, he's, because you're both Swedish,
mm-hmm.
he's the obvious kind of person that you've been compared with almost mm-hmm. from the beginning of your career, and he also kind of straight away endorsed you as a filmmaker back in the Leave the Fucking House days.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a mixed blessing in the sense that it's a little pressure, but at the same time, do you feel it's a bit arbitrary? Because your films and his films feel quite different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but I think that the thing that I really appreciate about what he said about my films, it's nice when people like my films, but he said something better about my second film, Together.
Mm.
And actually that he didn't like it that much. he didn't feel like it was as good as the first one. So he said that something like, but that's okay, now he just has to work. And I think that's sort of like my motto, that, you know, it doesn't matter if it turns out to be fantastic or if it's a failure, you just have to continue to work. So I even have that motto from him on my door.
Do you?
Yeah, or my office door, yes.
Just keep working.
Yeah, now he just has to keep working.
Oh, speaking of which, do you have a thought yet? Have you found inspiration? Because I know that you find inspiration in strange places as well as, mm-hmm. you know, your wife's work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an inspiration for your next project at this point, or is it too early to say?
Yeah, but that's really dangerous to answer. but if I'm pretending that no one is listening to this, then I could tell you that I'm very interested in old ladies.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not. It sounds
no,
like.
No.
Yeah. So maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like a sort of Harold and Maude type of old lady scenario, or no? Okay.
Couldn't tell you more because then I would kill the idea. But okay. Maybe an old lady.
Okay. We're and serious. Would it? Could you tell us whether it would be English, another English language, or would it be Swedish, potentially?
No, I feel very much at home in my language, in Swedish language, and I love Sweden, actually.
Fair enough. Got one final question. I know that you have three kids,
mm-hmm.
And you love doing Lego with them.
But they're too old for that.
They've outgrown Lego.
Yeah.
But we're like, we haven't outgrown Lego, and we're really old.
Yeah, but maybe it comes back later. But my oldest son is 18.
Oh,
you don't play with Lego.
Okay,
when
no, fair enough. Fair enough. Well, that ruined my question about which one of your movies you'd want to have a Lego set for.
Oh, but I would really love that. I would really love that.
Together would make a nice Lego set.
That would
it?
Be, yeah, that would be. Yeah, and this one too. We are the
van.
We are the best. Would be really
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, I think the punk haircuts would be great.
Yeah, and the guitars and the drums and the rehearsing place and
the gym. The gym with the benches.
The fish fingers that Bobo eats when she's alone. Yeah.
Brilliant. Love it. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. It's been a real pleasure. Lucas Moodison, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's make Lego fish fingers
That's
happen.
That's such a great idea.
I really love it. As soon as you see them in your mind's eye, you go, yeah. Someone's got to make that.
Lego fish fingers.
Time now for some lovely, lovely movie news. So what do we have?
I have some X-Men news. In fact, I have several bits of X-Men news. So let's start there, I think. First of all, there was a new trailer this week, which I highly recommend watching for my money. It is the best one so far, and it has a lot more Sentinel action than we have seen in any trailers to date, which means that those special effects are coming along nicely. So do check that out. It's on the website and, indeed, all over the internet.
Yay!
Also good news for True Blood fans and also Anna Paquin fans of whatever stripe. She apparently will appear in Days of Future Past after all, albeit in a blink and you'll miss it cameo by, you know, the looks of it. She is going to be there. It's just going to be a very, very brief appearance. So do look out for her. That is happening. Also, this is the perhaps slightly more interesting and less expected news. There is an X-Men Days of Future Past clip showing after The Amazing Spider-Man 2, certainly in some cinemas. We haven't been able to establish yet which cinemas or if it's only some showings, but it is basically a clip featuring Mystique, which shows after Spider-Man 2. Now, why is this the case, given that the two films come from competing studios and have, you know, no obvious connections? Well, apparently, rather boringly, it's all down to contract negotiations over Mark Webb, who's, of course, the Spider-Man director. He was contracted to Fox following his 500 Days of Summer. And as part of his contract negotiations to release him, to enable him to do The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Sony agreed to put this advert for Fox's X-Men film onto the end of their movie. Yeah. So it's not a credit sting in the way that we've seen with the Marvel movies. This does not set up a unified universe. It isn't a crossover with Spidey and the X-Men, which is a damn shame if you ask me. However, it is an interesting step. I mean, this has been attempted in the past. There were some negotiations before Avengers about putting the Oscorp Tower in the New York skyline of that movie. That didn't happen. That didn't pay off. Now, this is obviously not what we would want in that respect. This is not, you know, the studios all coming together and letting their characters play together, but, you know, maybe it's a sign of things to come, and in that case it wouldn't be so bad.
I see this as a ridiculously bad idea. Certainly for Fox it's a bad idea, and it's really confusing for audiences. We're getting so many people going, why is there an X-Men thing that has nothing to do with Spider-Man At the end of the movie, why not just put it at the beginning of the movie? It seems distracting to me. Most audiences now are conditioned to sit through one of these movies, a superhero movie in particular, and expect something at the end of the main credit sequence before the roller begins. And if it pops up and it's an advert for an entirely different movie, I'd feel A, a little bit cheated, B, a bit confused, and C, maybe even a little bit angry. I want something that pertains to the film I've just seen. Not something that's
well,
are you viewing it as just a trailer that's on the end?
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
That's the thing, it's not even a trailer. It's an unrelated clip that, as far as I'm aware, plays with absolutely no context at all. It's great for Fox, in a way, because they're getting word of mouth out about their movie on another studio's film. But for audiences, not so much. Okay, so let's move on. What's next?
Three sequel stories, just to touch on, and we can talk about them, obviously, afterwards. Channing Tatum has confirmed that Magic Mike 2 will be coming out in 2015, the big year, 2015. It's going to be coming out in July, so look forward to that.
Who's going to direct?
It's a guy called Greg Jacobs, who was a first assistant director for Steven Soderbergh on quite a few of his films. So it would seem like a passing of the torch, perhaps, to a kind of trusted collaborator.
Do we know this guy is actually a real person and not one of Steven Soderbergh's many aliases, first of all?
Well, there's a picture on IMDb of a handsome man with a beard, so I'm assuming that he's a real
Joe
person.
Joe Manganiello, isn't he?
He is, isn't he? Yes.
Bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like looking in a mirror for a Manganiello, I imagine.
Probably.
Maybe
given how enormously tall he is, like looking down a foot into a mirror. I don't know how tall Gregory Jacobs is. But
very tall.
Really
I'm
tall.
I'm guessing from that picture that you've called up on your screen. Awesome. And it's called Magic Mike XXL, which I think is the
ingenious.
Very, very good.
Other sequel news is that, yes, there will be a Puss in Boots 2. I actually thought this was already announced, as far as I'm concerned. I thought this was a done deal. I was lucky enough to be in DreamWorks a couple of months ago, and I saw some of the concept art for this film. I cannot reveal too much for obvious reasons, but Antonio Banderas does say that they're taking the spaghetti western idea and they're putting it in a new land, an entirely new land, and he is right. It is not necessarily where you'd expect that cat to go. But think kitty litter trays, and that's an oblique reference, even though it's not really.
Plymouth.
Are they going to call this one Puss in Boots XXL?
No, they're not. They're not. They decided
that's probably
not
for the best.
Yeah, maybe. The other sequel news is that Mrs. Doubtfire is apparently in the works
Is this Mrs. Doubtfire XXL?
Yes. Oh. It's going to reemerge with a latex mask and all sorts. I can only think of Mrs. Featherbottom. I can only think of Arrested Development. I can only think of, who wants a banger in the mouth? and then them saying, we call them a sausage over here. Who wants a sausage in the mouth?
Does he actually need latex anymore? Or just, I mean, with the greatest will in the world, he's now about the age that Mrs. Doubtfire was meant to be. So maybe all he needs is a good shave.
I want to see an entirely CGI Mrs. Doubtfire.
What do you mean he?
I mean, Robin Williams?
What?
No spoilers, but that is revealed in the film.
That's kind of the premise of the film, Chris.
What if I've only seen a Mrs. Doubtfire only cut of that movie?
When we were in Cannes once.
We were in Cannes last year.
Yeah, Chris and I were sitting down, a Mrs. Doubtfire impersonator, and by the way, Mrs. Doubtfire in France is called Madame Dutfire. Mm-hmm. So she just strolled up and was just walking around a restaurant that we were eating in, just talking to people, wasn't asking for money, it wasn't begging, it was just an eccentric man dressed as an older lady.
Yeah. The magic of Mrs. Doubtfire is still alive, and that is proof. And also proof is the fact that I've seen it twice in the last month. I don't know why. I'm not proud of it. But it is an enjoyable film.
I like it.
It's an enjoyable film. I mean, the new Blu-ray may have the worst animated menu you will ever see.
Oh, wow.
It's essentially stick figures with Pierce Brosnan and Robin Williams' face pasted onto them. It's a horror show.
I think just given people a reason to buy Blu-rays again.
Yes, exactly.
Take that, VOD.
I think it's a fun movie, and Pierce Brosnan's quite good in it.
He's excellent in it.
As Stuart.
I spoke to Pierce Brosnan for this, you know, career piece that I did maybe last year, and he talks about Madame Dutfire with great fondness. And actually, if they do a sequel, and it's still not confirmed that they will, I really hope that they have a scene where he shouts, "It's a drive-by fruiting!" But they won't.
Are they waiting for the Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie, to come out to see how successful that is before they tackle this one? Is that the idea?
I can't imagine that's what's holding them up. This has obviously been discussed before. Back when the first film came out, there was serious talk of a sequel pretty quickly, and it went on for years, and then it died. So I don't want to call this the Ghostbusters 3 of cross-dressing sequels, but, you know, it is one of those ones I'm slightly filing under. I'll believe it when I see it.
It was 1993 when this film came out. And there was a script written in 2001 for the sequel, and it got redone in 2004, 10 years after the fact.
93.
Wow. Feel old.
I swear, in Hollywood, God, Someone's just got a big list of films that came out in the early 90s. He's just ticking them off one by one. Right, we'll reboot that. We'll remake that.
Yeah. If they reboot Cool Runnings, I'm going to slaughter people.
It'll happen. Cooler Runnings.
Doubtfire 2 will come out, say, 2016, and then the third Mrs. Doubtfire film will obviously split into two because there's too much story to handle.
Absolutely.
So we'll have the third and fourth film in 2017.
The Desolation of Stuart.
The Desolation of Stuart.
I've got a couple of stories. Shall I kick them out there?
Yeah,
the week's big news, I'm surprised we haven't got around to this yet, is obviously the Star Wars news, the revelation that there will be something round in the film, because there's been the first set photo from Abu Dhabi, where they've started filming, and something metallic and round has been sighted.
What?
So what do you guys make of that?
Wow. I mean, it could be some kind of man-made structure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be some kind of alien creature that just happens to have like a metallic round skin.
It could be a table.
It could be a table. I mean, it could be like a Knights of the Round metallic table.
So you're saying there could be space knights?
There could be space knights. We'll call them kind of Jedi.
Yeah. What sort of swords would they have in space? That just doesn't sound realistic.
Long sabers?
Laser sword?
Oh, yeah. That sounds good.
Wow, this is really coming together.
So I did see somebody speculating online that it might be the foot of an AT-AT. I think people have gone a bit mental, haven't they? Can you say that on a podcast? I'm not sure.
No, you can.
So that's big. What next? Something square, possibly? Something tubular?
Well, we still haven't had any actors confirmed.
Unless they're inside this large round. Yeah. They're being wheeled around. Transport.
You realise instead of it being a Trojan horse, it's a Trojan AT-AT, where they just push an AT-AT into a tent, a massive tent, and outpour a variety of actors.
So and I've got something else which is slightly more concrete, which is that Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly are teaming up again for Adam McKay in a movie called Border Guards. It's not a big shock that those guys are getting back together. But the concept is that the two, Ferrell and Reilly, become guards on the border between America and Mexico. And then due to a wacky mix-up, they end up in Mexico without any identification, so they have to sneak across the furry border that they're hired to patrol.
High concept.
It's high concept. I am in, frankly, because I am always raving about Step Brothers. I think Anchorman's funny, but for me, Step Brothers is funnier. I love those three guys together, and I'm in.
And this is an original property, and I'm conscious of the fact that in our news story, sometimes it can be a bit like, here's the reboot, sequels, and superhero update, but that is new.
Mm.
In its own sweet way, that is new.
Awesome. Is that the movie news?
One more thing, and it's not worth going into at any great length. Following Mrs. Doubtfire, there's more fire news this morning. Sorry.
Good link.
Thank you.
Segue.
Just a call back. Yeah. Third Hobbit movie is currently titled There and Back Again, but there are currently rumours that they may be rethinking that title, that they may be ditching tradition and Tolkien's own subtitle for the book in favour of something a bit, you know, more action-y. And the current rumour has it that Into the Fire could be the new name of The Hobbit Part 3. Now, actually, like, if we're talking about the books, that is obviously a phrase that does occur. It's a chapter heading out of the frying pan into the fire, but that's about an incident that happens at the end of the first movie, so it is a little bit out of time. But I guess it would somewhat fit with everything that happens in the third film. I mean, I don't know, if you were going to retitle the film, I would have called it maybe Battle of the Five Armies or something,
which
quite
was registered actually by Warner Brothers. Indeed, a while back.
It's still going to be called The Hobbit, though, right? It's not called,
yeah, it's The Hobbit,
it's not
called
There and Back Again,
something
into the fire.
Something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or Iron Man 4. They're not going to call it that.
Probably not, although that would probably sell.
That would sell, I think. Into the Fire, as Bruce Springsteen fans all know, of course, is track 2 on his seminal 2002 album, The Rising. So I'm guessing Peter Jackson's a Springsteen fan. He could have gone for The Hobbit, Let's Be Friends, brackets Skin to Skin, or my personal favourite, The Hobbit, My City of Ruins. And I think that one fits.
Kind of does.
That one fits.
Yeah.
The Hobbit Part 3, Skin to Skin.
The Hobbit. I think I've seen that one.
Wow.
Yeah, it's genuinely called The Nobbit.
Yeah. Oh. Really?
Yeah, there is a porn parody
really?
Of The Hobbit called The Nobbit.
Tell me he's Dildo Baggins.
I do not know any more details than what I saw as the headline of a news story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't believe a word you're saying, my friend. So what's the... I'm just interested. I'm asking for a friend. What's it called again?
The Nobbit.
The Nobbit. Okay.
Is it 3D?
Oh, God, I
hope
not.
A fashion.
All right, let's move on now to our second and third interviews smudged together. It's a double whammy of spidery goodness. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 opened here in the UK on Wednesday, but doesn't open in the States, suck it, Johnny Yank, until May 2nd, which is why our usual spoiler special podcast will be held back until May 5th, in order to be fair to our American cousins. I take back that suck it, Johnny Yank thing. That spoiler podcast will feature the film's director, Mark Webb, and producers Avi Arad and Matt Tomac dishing as best as they can on pretty much all the major plot points of the web-slinging sequel. But until then, enjoy this double bill of non-spoiler interviews with them. You'll hear Arad and Tomac first, and they were talking to me and Helen. And then you're going to hear Mark Webb, who was talking to Helen and Ali Plum. And yes, at some point, we do talk about Spider-Man Underpants. Just roll with it. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined in the pod booth by the producers of The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Matt Tomac and Avi Arad. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be back.
Thank you. It's good to have you back. Avi, you are dressed like a Spider-Man billboard at the moment. You have a Spider-Man beanie cap on, you have a t-shirt. Matt, you are very well dressed in a suit. Why
this
do
is not a
you...
suit, by the way.
Well, it's a kind of, it's a jacket, it's
casual
cardigan.
Chic,
yeah, it's
I'd
very
like
nice.
It.
It's smart
Thank
cash. We'd like to have smart cash in the pod booth. Do you have anything Spider-Man on at the moment, or and why do you...
Where's have... your ring? I give you a ring.
You know, my ring is in the suitcase.
Oh, sure.
It's a little big.
The dog ate my homework.
Can I tell you something? Yeah, I have Spider-Man in my soul. The Spider-Man is actually coming out of my pores right now.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if Avi and I, and we've done this, if Avi and I are both wearing Spider-Man gear,
yeah,
then you're like rolling your eyes and saying like, oh, these guys, the marketing guys dress them up like billboards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Avi gets the swag.
I get $10
a
day.
And my son wears all mine.
You and I know each other forever.
Yeah.
So you know that I always, I mean, almost to a ridiculous level, wore Marvel Blink.
Yeah,
I mean, that's...
Absolutely.
The main reason was that I got it for free. So I haven't...
It is the truth.
I haven't gone shopping forever.
That is Chris as well. Chris
you
just
see?
Wears movie t-shirts.
Yeah, that's a
pretty
whole
much,
reason to be
much.
In this highly visual, exciting business. And it, you know what? It was always a way of life.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know. I was defined by Marvel. I never thought I'd make a living at it.
Yeah.
I said, okay, at least I have something I love. And long and behold, the world fell for this, and the rest is history.
It looks
but
good.
I think it looks also, there is another thing that I have to admit. I love this jacket, but at my weight class, I don't think they make that.
I want you to try this jacket on.
I'll tear it just by putting it on. So.
That's nice, but you know, not to pry too deeply, but
go.
Spider-Man boxer shorts, Spider-Man briefs.
Everything.
Yeah.
I have... Oh, you mean on right now?
On right now, yeah.
No. As I said, right now I'm just dressed like any other civilian.
Chris, we've discussed you asking about visitors' pants before. Please.
You can ask about my underwear anytime.
It's my thing.
It's my thing.
I have to jump in. We are in Singapore, right? And this waiter that let us into this club area, whatever. You have to belong to the club. It's like the pool, top of the world, and so on. And he comes over. He wants to take a picture. He wants an autograph. And then he opens his pants. And it's Singapore. I didn't think they do that. And he shows me his Spider-Man skivvies. That's the power of Spider-Man.
Are you interested in whether I'm wearing Spider-Man underwear? Or do you just want to know if that was like the boxers or briefs thing? That's what you're trying to get to.
Well, yeah, that's clearly
boxers.
As you know, I'm a hard-hitting journalist.
Yeah, no, I like to. And you were very subtle about the way you got to it.
It's the questions that matter. That's the only question I ask.
And I'm not shy. I'm not shy.
Amazing Spider-Man 2 is how big a challenge was it to get this one? Because there were 2 years pretty much between this movie and the last movie. Was that a tough challenge for you getting something off the ground this quickly? I mean, this big as well.
It was, yeah. I mean, these movies, big movies like this are really hard to make. At the same time, there was never a moment where we weren't doing it or that we were doubting it. The truth is we were plotting this movie while we were sitting here talking to you on the last movie. And plotting it on a lot of levels, plotting who was going to write it. We spent a lot of time talking to you and to a lot of people about an obligation we had in the last movie to tell the origin story, because, here we were introducing a new filmmaker, but a new Peter Parker, most importantly. And we felt we had to start at the beginning, and all of the stuff that comes with having to tell the origin story and how it limits to a certain degree how far you can actually go with Spider-Man. And so we knew then the next movie was going to be about Spider-Man. If the first movie was about sort of becoming Spider-Man, this movie is about being Spider-Man and all the things that Peter Parker has to contend with. First and foremost, loving being Spider-Man. It's not about being conflicted about being Spider-Man at the beginning. It's about, I am Spider-Man and it's awesome and I'm good at it. Does it become really complicated for him? Forget it. It becomes ridiculously complicated. The risks are so enormous. The jeopardy for people in his world are so enormous. We knew where we wanted to go then, and we had a lot to do to build it.
We also had, in all fairness, we've been doing it now for 14 years. So for us, I think we are uniquely qualified to make these giant movies. If someone went into it, never done this size movie, this size effects, it would have been overwhelming. And probably wouldn't come out as well. We also have a major advantage with Sony Digital. You walk from your office downstairs across the road and you are seeing progress. The talent on the movie, the technical talent, which is incredibly important in movies like that. We knew that Andrew is a one in a generation. It's a very unique actor. We knew that Webb is a relationship guy. We had the best producers in the business.
That's us. The two of us.
A great writing team, and we had to be, in a way, very focused, not to listen too much. This is what we had to do. This was the release date, but I don't know. We did four Spider-Man movies before that, so we knew where
you know how to build to them. You know how to build them. The thing that Alex Kurtzman and Jeff Pinkner and Bob Orsi did for us was also a huge part of making it possible. They gave us a script. You know, every script goes through changes and rewrites and tweaks and all that, but they gave us a script right away that was spectacular. And so you have the wind at your back when that happens, and that's really rare.
How much input as well, though, to the character of Peter and Spidey does Andrew get? Because I get the sense that this is a guy who's been in love with this character for as long as, his entire
life.
Much. He does wear Spidey briefs.
He does.
and he seems to be someone who can probably improvise in both characters. So how much input does he get into what Peter does?
Yeah. A lot. I mean, again, in this specific movie, he was so in love with the script when he got it that it liberated him to be able to really just embellish. So it was sort of a dream for him to be able to give in this story that he utterly believed in, and then just imbue the character with the stuff that he's so brilliant about. And he's a very, very serious and intense actor. He's hilarious and loves to sort of play, but he likes to also get under the skin of Peter Parker and of Spider-Man. And that's a real part of the process. And he spent a lot of time with Mark and the writers, frankly, really trying to, you know, he's, the great thing about Andrew is he questions everything in the most honest and genuine way. He wants to believe what's happening. He wants to, he so loves this character that he kind of has this great BS detector for a moment that feels, you know, inauthentically Peter Parker or Spider-Man.
A Spidey sense, if you will.
He has a Spidey sense about Spidey. And
I think in movie one, listen, it was his first giant movie.
Yeah.
And it's a huge responsibility to become the next Spider-Man. So I think he had to hold back. It's just human nature. And this one, he came in, that was him. He was part of the team. He was comfortable with comedy because he understood, and his sense of timing, by the way. Mm. I mean, he's shockingly funny. Mm. But I mean shockingly, because if you meet him, he's more serious and charming. He's fantastic. Some of the physical comedy that actually he brought this guy from England.
He brought a guy named Cal, who's a sort of a, I don't want to say,
slapstick. Director.
Slapstick clown, and you know he does that. That's what he does. And there's you've seen the movie. There's a there's a moment in the movie, the elevator bank sequence, that was shot. I mean, it was all shot in one. You know, it was all literally choreographed so that you went from one practical stunt to another. So that's another side of Andrew. He's super intense. He's
so hard,
you know,
to do.
He's funny, but he's also a great physical comedian. And he really wanted to bring that out. The comedy on this movie was also a big part of what we wanted to do. We put together a round table, a comedy round table, which, you know, you sometimes do on movies, of people who love Spider-Man and who are funny, to just go through the script and find jokes and moments. Because, you know, you've got Andrew and Emma, who's hilarious, and Jamie Foxx, and you know, Paul Giamatti, you better mind that. And so we had this kind of dream team of really funny, talented people.
Even Dane became funny.
He did.
Like, yeah. Sally is awesome.
She's amazing.
Giamatti is amazing in this film.
Isn't he great?
Because he starts at 11.
Yeah.
So for future installments,
and he finishes at 12.
I don't know where he finishes.
It's a slim range. He's like, he goes from 11 to 12.
Where is there left to go for him? I mean, is there any scenery left in New York? This guy is astonishing. You just wind him up and let him go.
He's brilliant. And he had so much fun on the movie.
Always wanted to be.
Yeah.
We read about the talk show.
Yeah. It just, the movie wanted that, you know, that like there's plenty of intensity with the villains, but like, why not? It's the Rhino. It's not the most complex of Marvel villains. And I think he immediately got that, you know, that he is just pandemonium in the streets. And it was awesome to see him do it. He was, you know, he's such an unbelievable actor, and he was just completely committed to this insane character walking around in this Russian, you know, sort of mobster tracksuit. You know, it was really wild. It was great.
I kill you, a spider. Amazing. Does he wear Rhino briefs or Rhino boxers, do you think?
Exclusively. He signed a deal with Rhino briefs.
He's fully dedicated.
That's a company.
So will other actors now see this as a way in to the Spidey universe if they go on talk shows and go, I've long been a fan of the Scorpion?
Yes.
Maybe
that's what they
should do.
Yeah. They should start doing that now. Because we sit up and watch late night television. That's how we cast our movies. What we do.
Be careful what you wish for.
That's right.
But there's a lot of humor in the film, and without going into spoiler, because it's very, very early in the film, but Spider-Man, Peter, has as his ringtone a very famous theme tune.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Whose idea was that?
Actually, the idea came from Andrew.
That was Garfield. Garfield and Webb. Garfield and Webb. Together.
It was Garfield who asked, do we have the rights for it?
Yeah.
And did you?
Huh?
Yeah. Did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, lucky.
Hopefully, because it's in the movie. So the Sony lawyers are scrambling.
Well, it doesn't come out for another four or five days. So you should be fine.
For years, we tried to get the sound from this family in New Jersey. It took forever, and it's always like it has no value until you ask for it.
Yeah.
This is a holy grail. You know? But it. If you saw it with people, you see they laugh when they hear this.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast. We're joined today by Mark Webb. Hello.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Excellent. And The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is looking like it's going to be a very big hit.
Oh, really?
I think so. Well, you know, it kind of has those signs.
What are the signs that you, you on the spot?
On every single bus that I go past, for a start. There's a lot of talk about it on Twitter as well, which, as we know, is very important.
Yes, it is.
I've got to begin with a very important question, which I'm sure no one has asked you before. Uh-huh. So Bing is out. Gmail is in.
It is. Well, Google is in. There was such a backlash to the Bing.
The
Bing backlash that we had to embrace Google this time around. You know, I don't remember where that decision came from. It was just, I think Google seemed so ominous and so large that we wanted to be anti and people just didn't buy it.
Google was a bit Oscorp. You didn't want to be too Oscorp.
Yeah, exactly.
What it should have been is AltaVista, but you know.
Do you use AltaVista?
All the time. That and Rycos, yeah.
Oh, good for you, man. That's impressive.
So techie.
So techie, yeah. Anyway.
So apart from deciding which search engine for Peter Parker to use, what was the biggest challenge this time? Like when you sat down and you started planning it all those many, many moons ago.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of challenges. I think that we're trying to broaden the scope of the movie, you know, and make it a really big, spectacular event for the audience to enjoy. I think there was, you know, you're trying to continue the story of Peter Parker and give people new things to engage in and new characters to engage in, new storylines to engage in without undermining the iconic elements that people love. And I mean, there's just there are logistical demands because we're shooting in New York, which is the biggest movie ever shot in New York, and that was a real challenge from the get-go. Big movies are hard in that way always, but because it was in New York, it was a little tricky. But it ended up being really great.
And speaking of iconic things that are part of the Spider-Man mythos, is the quips. Uh-huh. Is, you know, I've played enough Spider-Man games that they kind of circle around my head because you hear them over and over. Yeah. But in this film, notably, you had so many more.
Yeah.
Like, was it fun to really unleash that? Because he's so much more confident as himself.
Like, quips come from an element of his character, which is, well, of confidence is one part of it. And then it's also, he's trying to throw the villains off balance. Like, and there's that opening sequence where there's where he's trying to stop Alexei Sestevich. And, you know, Spider-Man is always trying to come at these villains and his situations from the side. He doesn't come and just knock people out. He goes to the side of the car and, like, he starts to talk to him, you know, and, like, does things in a way that is, he's more like a trickster. You know what I mean? And that quip is such, I think, which is why you love the comics, why people love the comics so much, is he had this teenage sensibility. And that was something that we really, you know, we introduced it, I think, in the last movie, but really wanted to embrace it and, like, start off with a fun, playful version of what Spider-Man is.
I would love to know what was too off color. Sorry. To not make it. Like, somebody just going, oh, wait, no, not going to go
in. I got to be honest. There was one moment where, during one of the battles with Electro, where Spider-Man gets decimated by a huge, you know, Electro blow, and he collapses to the ground. And, like, Andrew, like, when we were doing the stunt, like, he was like, oh, shit. And, like, it was, like, it killed, but we just couldn't have that. You know, it's like there's kids and, like, yeah, we didn't want to alienate, you know, parents. But it was a really funny moment. But you do have to protect some people when you're doing that. So there was there was one profanity that we cut out.
It would be amazing if he did any English, you know. He said, oh, bugger. Whoops. No, sorry. I'm out of character.
Oh. He also got some physical comedy this time.
Yeah.
He worked with a clown, I believe.
Well, there's a guy named Cal McChrystal who's a Brit who Andrew had heard about and we brought in, and he sort of helped consult and choreograph some of these sequences. There's a sequence where Peter Parker, it's not a Spider-Man thing, but it's where Peter Parker is trying to, like, you know, detain some of Gwen Stacy's pursuers, and he just gets in this. He plays this. He's basically playing dumb and like knocks over all these guys in a very funny, playful way. And it's interesting because it's that kind of choreography, as playful as it is really difficult. Yeah. We had to do like 17 takes because it was like one long thing, and him, he's spilling coffee here and tripping somebody here, and all the while pretending not to do anything. We did a little bit out of the first movie. Like there's this subway sequence where he's kind of playfully, unintentionally knocking all these people out. And it was really fun. And it takes a lot of time to shoot, but the payoff is quite good.
Yeah.
You know, but that's like action movies. It's kind of the only place where you can do physical comedy, or you can really embrace physical comedy. Like comedies do it occasionally, but there's something, it's a rare thing. Because they used to do it like, you know, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd. They did these, they were really exceptional, extraordinary virtuosos, physically adept people. And they built a whole universe around it. It came from the vaudeville era, of course. And that level of skill, it doesn't exist anymore. No. Just, people don't practice it
you
as
get
much.
Tiny little bits here and there. You got, you know, Johnny Depp did a bit in Benny and June, and yeah, you had Jackie Chan doing a bit in, I think, Shanghai Nights.
Yeah.
But we don't have that anymore.
Well, Jackie Chan, like, so there's some, like, there's a lot of Chinese opera stuff that is really exceptional, where they do play around with that. But it's that there is a, sometimes there's a kung fu or like a, you know, a martial arts component to it.
Yeah.
But it's rare. I think there's a huge opportunity there, and something that people, I talked about this on the Comic-Con panel a little bit. There is like on 500 Days of Summer, I remember when I showed the movie the first time at Sundance, there's a big dance sequence, and it was kind of, it's a weird kind of thing to have in a movie that's not a musical. But people enjoy that kind of thing in a way. It's not laughter, but it's not like crying. It's not like some cathartic experience, but there is some thing that people love and really resonates with people when they see acts of physical virtuosity, yeah, you know, and expression. And when people, it's what, it can be a fight or it can be a dance, and physical comedy is one part of that, but it doesn't, you just don't see it very much. Yeah. Like people love slapstick, and the more complicated and nuanced it gets, the more they enjoy it, you know. And we got to dabble in that, I think, in just bits and pieces here, but I think it's, the audience has so far has really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. If I'm reading you right, what you're saying is for the sequel, he'll be singing a song?
Yes, he'll be singing a song. He'll be doing a soft shoe.
Nice.
Yeah, he has a cane and a top hat. It's going to be killer.
A Michael Jackson experience.
As we get to the reviews section of the pod, we should obviously start with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which I'm sure most of you who listen to this have already seen. But anyway, nevertheless, what are our thoughts on this one? The Amazing Spider, Helen, go.
Thank you. I will keep it non-spoilery, obviously. I think a better film than the first one. It's a good bit more fun than the first one. You've got Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone still being utterly, improbably, impossibly adorable as Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy, particularly when they're on screen together. These two are the human equivalent of a Labrador puppy. I mean, they're absolutely lovely. And that kind of helps the film along enormously. You also have new villains in the shape of Jamie Foxx's really downtrodden, put upon Max Dillon, who is just this incredibly tragic figure that you just want to get help, and instead he falls into he falls into a vat of electric eels and gets these unfortunate superpowers, which is kind of the opposite of a hug as life experience goes, which is
unless
sad.
You're an eel, another eel.
Unless you're another eel, in which case, hurrah! He is obviously he kind of meets Spider-Man early on in the film, thinks they've formed a bond, and is devastated when Spider-Man then proves unable to help him deal with all of this stuff that he's going through, and he goes rather swiftly to the bad. Also a new character is Dane DeHaan's Harry Osborn, who comes back from boarding school. It turns out he's an old friend of Peter's, and he comes back to sit at essentially the deathbed of his father Norman, who's played by Chris Cooper, and then to take over his father's company. And you know, any of you who've seen the previous films or read the comics knows that probably some bad stuff is in store for Harry as well. Frankly, if you've seen the trailer for this film, one of the many trailers for this film.
Or clip number 900.
Yes. Then you will also know what's in store for Harry in this one. So it's a much more complicated plot, which means it's a much longer running time, because in fairness to Mark Webb, he hasn't ditched all of the character stuff to fit in all of these bad guys, to fit in all of this action. I think in that respect, you know, he's he's somewhat taking the right approach, because if you're going to set all of this stuff up, you need to give a little bit of room for everybody to still breathe around the edges. If you're going to have a lot of bad guys and a lot of plot happening, you still need to fit in moments of character stuff. There's a lovely bit with Aunt May and Peter Parker discussing washing clothes. He's trying to sneak his spider suit into the washing machine without her seeing. And it's actually a nice little scene. It's quite a funny little moment. There's bits with Spider-Man's graduation, because it starts with him graduating from high school. So there are still the little kind of character beats that clearly are important to Webb. But then they've also got a heck of a lot of story to service. So this is a long film. This is a 2-hour, 20-minute film. But, you know, it does keep motoring along for the most part. I've got a few niggles, but generally speaking, you know, not bad.
It does the job. I don't feel like it's in any way a perfect film at all.
No.
There are a few moments where you just go, what? Why? But what makes it work for me is the two of them, Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield. That really does work. I also enjoyed how we discussed this in the interview, that they've updated the niggles that people had with the first film. People didn't like the way they did the web swinging. They didn't like the POV. They called it like a bad video game. I really think they got that right now. They changed the camera angles a lot. I felt the CGI was better done. He doesn't use Bing anymore. He uses Gmail. This is important. And what was the other thing that they do that I was quite pleased with?
Gwen Stacy's coats.
Music.
Spider-Man. He's in the film.
Gwen Stacy's coats are wonderful. I mean, I was genuinely really impressed by that. Like yellow, cream, she looks wonderful. You will fall in love with Emma Stone. If you haven't already, you will fall in love with her again.
I agree with you that they're both good. They work very well together. I preferred this to the first film, which I really, really disliked, and I thought this one was quite a bit better. I still didn't think that the villains were particularly effective. I thought Dane DeHaan was good when he got going, but that was quite near the end of a 2.5-hour film. Electro looks fantastic. I think the effects are amazing on the big screen. But I think the character itself is perhaps not so good. He's basically Dwayne Dibley from Red Dwarf. He literally is. He's got the comb over. You guys were saying it's a tragic thing. I mean, honestly, people forget his birthday, and that's why he's really angry in this film. I thought he turned into a bit of a generic bad guy.
The tone hops around. Yeah. It really does. Like, it will be... It's funny, because I love it, actually. On its own measurement, I really like the in-depth emotional connection between these two and how it's really serious and things are important. But then when he's swinging around the city, he's doing all the quips. At one point, he refers to Electro as Sparkles. That's his nickname. And it totally ups the quip factor. Because in the first film, there's that one quip where this thug, street thug, comes up to Spider-Man and he goes, "Oh, you got my one weakness, small knives," and then just slings his knives out of his hand. Here they just up the quips exponentially. Anyway, so he calls him Sparkles, and at one moment later on in the film, guess what? They come to blows, Electro and Spider-Man. Electro says, and this kind of sets the tone for the dialogue sometimes, something along the lines of, "I will join the pantheon of the gods," or "I will become a god." And then in this really tense scene, when you're really like genuinely, oh, what's going to happen, Spider-Man then goes, "A god called Sparkles?"
Electro also says, "It's my birthday. I'm going to light some candles," and then proceeds to blow stuff up. There is stuff about it that's a bit dodgy. The action is pretty great, I thought. There's a huge set piece in Times Square, which I really, really liked. And I thought all the Green Goblin stuff at the end was very well executed.
Yeah, the action is better, significantly. And the Lizard is a poorer bad guy compared to these two.
Yeah, well, the Lizard also looked awful, which you know, gives these two kind of a head start.
Yeah,
immediately, because they're better designed characters.
There are fewer lumps of dodgy looking CG.
Yeah, sure. There's still the whole sort of conspiracy thing involving Peter Parker's dad, which I always find a bit of a distraction from the whole thing. The number of coincidences in this version of his story, I think, does kind of reach a whole new level. I mean, even, and this is a really silly, I know we all kind of talked about this last time, but organic web slingers, I know they're not canon in the comics, but they actually make a lot more sense. And they're actually a lot more elegant of a solution than the mechanical ones he has in this one. Because we're meant to believe that the guy who's bitten by a spider, who also was, you know, Lala, giant history with his dad and these spiders, but also happens to develop a spider web-like substance, which he can then use for his endeavours. It just seems a little bit far-fetched, and I haven't ever quite got past that. I also think, while I adore Peter Parker and Emma Stone together, and I think they're great together and their scenes are sparky and wonderful. I'm not sure they're actually the characters. I'm not sure that's what I'm loving about them. I think I'm just loving them being Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone.
I think
Stone
I
sometimes.
May be the only guy to prefer Tobey Maguire's version, because I've not talked to anyone who agrees with me, but I just think Tobey Maguire's better. I think he suits the role better.
I think he's closer to the role. I love Andrew Garfield and I think he's great and I would happily watch him, but I'm not sure I'm watching Spider-Man or Peter Parker. I feel like I'm just watching somebody awesome be awesome.
Yes, I have an ally.
Together, you and I against the world.
When enemies unite.
Hey.
So anyway, I mean, yeah, this was a big step up from the first one, and we give it 3 stars.
3 stars then for The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And a reminder that the Spider-Man 2 spoiler special will be up on Monday, May 5th. That's Monday, May 5th. And speaking of other specials, before we get on to the rest of the reviews, we had a legendary film critic, Barry Norman, into the pod booth recently. And why not? If you want to hear the fantastic special interview with him talking about his great loves, from film, of course, to his late wife, Diana, the subject of his new book, See You in the Morning, download it now because it's totally worth it. And I believe, Ali, we have a quick competition.
Very quick one. Competition. Yes. In Phil's absence, he asked me to do a little quiz because we've got a copy, a hardback copy of Barry Norman, See You in the Morning, signed by the great man. And to win it, all you have to do is email in to podcastemperonline.com and answer to this question: which of the following 3 movies is not in Barry Norman's 100 best films of the century, obviously the 20th century? So which of the following 3 films is not in there? Duck Soup, Rashomon, Ghostbusters 2.
Ghostbusters 2 has to be in there. It has to be in there.
You think so?
It has to be in there.
You'd think so.
If not, there will be bloody hell to pay.
There will be bloody hell to pay. All right, interesting. So send in your answer, marked Barry Norman, I guess, to podcast@emperoronline.com with your details and your address. And we'll pick a winner, we'll announce it next week's show, and we'll send you that book ASAP. Okay, back to the reviews now, and the other big release of the week, the complete antithesis of the big-budget Spider-Man 2. It's Locke, a Stephen Knight high concept but low-budget drama in which Tom Hardy plays a man named Ivan Locke, who's driving from Birmingham to London and has to navigate various crises via his mobile phone. And that's it. That is it. The action never leaves the cards, all rooted in Hardy's character, with phone cameos, or famios, from the likes of Ruth Wilson, Alice Lowe, Tom Holland, and Olivia Colman. So, what did we make of the film about a man in a car?
I think it's very impressive, this film. It is an experiment, is how I describe it, a very novel experiment. It feels like a play, and part of the reason why it does feel like a play is because it was shot over the course of 8 nights, where it was filmed, the whole film was filmed 8 nights on the trot, where he would drive down the M6, Tom Hardy, sporting an impressive beard and an equally impressive Welsh accent, as he makes his way through this conundrum that he's facing. It's more serious than actually the word conundrum indicates. It's about a man who's made a decision to do right by a mistake he's made. He's made a mistake and he wants to do right by the person that it's kind of got him tangled up with. And it's a character study. A lot of the shots are just him through a window or him through the reflection of a mirror. So it's not going to certainly blow your mind visually in the way, say, Amazing Spider-Man 2 might, possibly. So yeah, it is very insular and very close. And you can see how possibly different nights of the shoot were kind of edited together. It's directed by Stephen Knight, who previously wrote such films as Eastern Promises and Dirty Pretty Things. He obviously wrote this. He wrote this one as well as directing it. His last film was Hummingbird, which, as much as I love Jason Statham, is not a very good film.
I like that film.
Oh, it's terrible.
I like that film.
It too long didn't work. For my money. This one does work, though the way the posters, because it's been critically revered by pretty much everyone who has access to the internet as a fantastic film. I think it's a very good film, but it's kind of being sold, certainly in the trailer I saw recently, I saw it again last night, as a thriller. And it isn't really a thriller. It's more of a character study that can get tense at times. It can also be funny. It can also get you very interested in how buildings are constructed, because it involves Ivan Locke, this character, is trying to, through a phone, tell somebody else how to create the foundations of an incredibly tall skyscraper. I want to do this justice, but it's difficult to make people excited about it when you actually dig into it, the nitty-gritty of what
works,
it is.
Though. It wins you over. Mm. I saw this quite a while ago. I think it might have been the first screening, actually. I was quite lucky enough to see it. And I had no idea what this was. All I knew was Tom Hardy was in a car, and I went in thinking there'd be a bomb in the petrol tank or something, and I thought it would be a high-concept action film. And it's obviously not an action film at all. Unless you count Changing Gears, but it's terrific. It completely wins you over. It's really tense. He's literally the only person you see in this film, and you're just completely gripped by it. Great showcase for Hardy. Really a real success for Knight, I think. He set out to make this about the most ordinary person you could possibly make a film about, and put him in quite an extreme emotional situation. And I loved it, even though at no point does he sing Roachford Cuddly Toy, which might have improved it slightly. But no, it's a cracking film.
It really is. He also props for his... He does a sort of a Richard Burton-esque kind of a Welsh accent, and it just... He's a man who you can immediately see is a sort of a quiet, unassuming guy, in whom, however, he seems incredibly steady, and therefore for him to be... driven to the edge like this, is it kind of heightens the drama, because you come to realize quite quickly what a kind of steady, dependable guy he is, and you also come to realize how it's all going horribly wrong for him, and that the contrast between those two is absolutely brilliantly done. The film sometimes, I mean, I think shooting entirely on the drive and only focusing on him, you know, there are moments where you get a little bit sick of, you know, out of focus motorway lights, which there's quite a lot of, but I mean, given the confines of the sort of the premise, it's very, very well done indeed.
If you're curious about this film, do go and see your local very small cinema, because chances are it's not going to be in many multiplexes. But if you're intrigued in any way, it'd be good to support films like this, because they're very rare.
Absolutely. It would make a good double bill with Buried, the Ryan Reynolds film that not very many people saw, but I'm a big fan of.
And Stephen Dorff's film Break, where it's him in the back of a car.
Amazing.
It's not very good.
Absolutely amazing.
Well, he's in the boot, or is he in the back boot. Seat?
He's in the boot.
The whole film is in the boot.
Not the whole film, but yeah.
Das Boot.
This is just a night out you had with Stephen Dorff. Not a real film, Ali. We've talked about this.
Oh, sorry.
Interestingly enough, I love this fact. I don't know if you guys know this, but Stephen Knight is the co-creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which makes him richer than God, essentially.
Wow.
And did you also know that Frank Rodham, the director of Quadrophenia, that fantastic mod classic, is the creator of MasterChef, which also makes him richer than God?
I did not know either of those. I'd known that when I interviewed Stephen Knight. I would have asked him for some money. Damn it. I wondered why he was drinking champagne and pouring it all over the ground.
As Peter Buck called his new album, I am back once again to blow your mind. Full of facts, me. You're not the only one who can come over here with facts and quizzes, Plum. Should we move on to We Are the Best? We had Lucas Moodysson on the show.
Hello, yes. This is a sort of a punk movie, a punk teen coming-of-age movie. So two school pals called Bobo and Clara, they decide they're going to form a punk band, which is brilliant. You know, they look the part, they've got the hair, they've got the attitude. It's 1982 in Stockholm. What better time to form a punk band? Only problem being, they can't actually play at all. And I know that it sometimes doesn't sound like it with punk music, but you do, you know, some kind of musical ability is a bonus. So luckily, they get a friend to join them, or a slightly straight-laced person who isn't quite a friend to begin with, called Hedvig, to join them, and she can actually play guitar. So they bring her in. The music is still pretty terrible, but it's not so much about the music. This is not the Commitments. It's more about just the friendship between these three, the sort of, you know, teen spirit between them. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a surprisingly upbeat film for Lucas Moodysson, because I think we've gotten used to him bringing us rather more... depressing, well, no, let's say downbeat kind of films, and this is a much more kind of positive and almost life affirming, you know, option. So you know, they're not exactly the greatest band in the world, but it's still a really kind of feel good story. So we give this four stars.
We like here this movie. Four stars for We Are the Best, which ties it for best film. What? Don't look at me like that.
Looking
which ties
like
it for
that.
Best film of the week with luck. Also out this week is the animated movie Wrinkles, which we gave 3 stars. There's Pierce Brosnan and Emma Thompson displaying what Kim Newman calls easy chemistry, and Joel Hopkins sort of, I don't know, Twilight-y, not Twilight the movies, but Twilight of Their Lives, heist thriller. The Love Punch, which gets 3 stars as well. And Michael Cera and Juno Temple are also in Magic Magic, which we give 3 stars to as well. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Martin Freeman, who's here to talk about his new TV show based on Fargo. I believe the title is Fargo. And if all goes well, Mrs. Featherbottom herself, Mr. David Cross, comedian turned director, he's launching his debut movie Hits at Sundance London from April 24th onwards. He'll be here on the podcast as well. Very exciting times. Maybe he'll stick a banger in our mouths. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Ew. Goodbye.
What's that? It's goodbye. Ew. It's goodbye from, what's your name? Fuck. Ali. It's goodbye from Nick.
I can't do that. So.
Okay.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to look for Easter eggs in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And eat the hell out of them. See you next week, guys. Happy Easter. Enjoy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Woo. Love you.